I am happy to introduce a former president of the Denver Rose Society. She has been she has a million awards and so much experience and so much information, and is a great writer too. I'm really marveling at our speaker's breadth of experience. So I'm going to tell you some of her accomplishments, and I could go on and on, but I'll try to highlight the tips of the icebergs for now. So she was awarded the Rocky Mountain District Silver Honor Medal and the Denver Rose Society Bronze Medal. And Joan has been a Master Rosarian with the distinction of Rocky Mountain District Outstanding Consulting Rosarian. And as I said, she frequently writes articles and educational materials on roses, as well as giving programs on roses very often. And you'll get a taste for how this obviously is really our speaker's passion today, and it just comes from her heart, and I think it's so lovely. So she grows about 125 roses of all different types at her own home, including hybrid teas, grandifloras, floribundas, polyanthas, miniatures, climbers, old garden roses, Canadian hardy roses, and English or Austin roses, as well as shrubs and species roses. She's also the designer of the historical Rose Garden in Hudson Gardens in Littleton, Colorado, and the public Rose Garden at T.H. Pickens Technical School. So without further ado, Joan Franson is our accomplished Master Rosarian. Welcome, Joan.
Thank you, Ava. It's been fun to anticipate talking with you about roses, because I do love roses.
I can tell. And, you know, the roses that I just listed off that you grow, honestly, even though I have been meddling in the plant world for 20-plus years myself now, I think those are more types of roses than I have even heard of, and I bet a lot of those.
And there's many more than that. This is what makes roses sometimes confusing. When you're trying to select the rose for your garden in areas that are not the deep south or the west coast or something like this where everything grows, we do have so many kinds of roses available to us, and people aren't even aware that they exist. And they're so fun to discover about.
Mm-hmm.
I think when people think about roses, they think of like the hybrid tea, which was typically the florist rose, and they think that that's the only rose there is. Or they may have seen little miniature roses growing in pots at the grocery store and think, gee, those look like roses too. And it's true, but there are so many other kinds that are much hardier and can be grown, I think, almost anywhere.
Great. And I know you plan to share with us today some of the toughest ones for our conditions and locations here in the interior west. Let me first ask you, before we go into the real crux of the matter here, a few questions about yourself, Joan, just to give us all a better feel for who you are as a gardener and what sets your world on fire about gardening and roses. So will you share with us where and how you first started gardening?
Let's see. When I was just a kid, my dad always grew roses. Mm. And I can remember those growing in the backyard, even a variety like Mrs. Sam McCready, which is available today, of a hybrid tea type. And when we had lived for a short time in Kansas, this was in Indiana, Hammond, Indiana. We lived for a short time in just outside Kansas City, Missouri, and we had in that backyard there a rose he liked so much he dug a portion of it up and brought a big chunk of it back home to Indiana. And I believe now that was Rosa Hansa, which is one of the Rugosa roses. Very tough rose, could take just about anything, even being a hunk of it dug up and carried out to our yard and planted there. It's a rose that is red, but it's in the purpled red field, and it has great fragrance, tough as nails, and interesting wrinkled foliage or deeply impressed veins. So when my husband and I were married a year and a half, we lived in an apartment and then moved to our home, had to have roses. Since I knew nothing about roses, I took a class, and the man who taught the class saw how interested I was in roses, so he said, you ought to join the American Rose Society, which I did back in 1959. And it's just been roses ever since. I live in Denver because of roses. We had come out to see what a rose convention was, never having heard of a rose convention. And when we got home, we were very upset, so we thought about it for a week, put the house up for sale, and moved back to Denver.
Wow, and because of roses.
Because of roses.
And what? And how long have you been in the Denver area now then?
Since 1960. We came in the fall of 1960. And in 1961, I joined a Rose Society, Garden Club, and Denver Botanic Gardens, and life has never been the same since.
I believe that.
I just love them.
Great.
People are so friendly and want to help you grow roses and avoid the mistakes they made, and that's what makes it easier to grow when you have some experience you can bank on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And what is your native soil like where you live now and your elevation?
Well, I live on what you'd practically call bentonite hill.
Mm-hmm.
This stuff is so gummy thick that in August, if you want to dig, you need blasting caps, I think. It kind of peels off like wood shavings. And digging a real hole takes much more than determination. But it's a good soil. Bentonite clay or any clay soils are good soils. They're so recently having come down from being rock in the mountains, they have all the nutrients, and the nutrients aren't used up. Like soil in Massachusetts probably has had all of its good parts of minerals taken out and needs more amendment, where we have the soil here that's great, but it needs to have air space. And so when you do plant almost anything, but especially roses that want good drainage, you need to take that good soil and, with preparation, create air space by adding amendments.
Mm-hmm.
And then the roses will drain well, which is important.
Right. I know you'll be talking a little more about that as we go.
Mm-hmm.
So let me first ask you your elevation, too.
We're about a mile high. My house is probably 400 feet higher than Denver, so it would be about 5,800.
Okay.
And it's good in that way, because what I like living in this area, we've grown roses in Indiana and in Oklahoma and back in Colorado twice. I'd rather grow roses here. We don't have the humidity, which would be beneficial in many ways, but because of that dryness, the roses do better, I think. The color is richer because we're a mile high and closer to the sun. The insects and disease problem is much lessened compared to Portland, Oregon, where they're always spraying for something.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes growing roses easier. In the mountain areas, we don't have as long a season, but what we do have, we can certainly take advantage of and enjoy the many forms that roses come in and the many ways they can be used.
Yes. Great.
I think a lot of people think only of hybrid teas, and those are best, I believe, grown in groups so they're similar together in a bed of hybrid teas. But with the other kinds of shrub roses, you can do all kinds of things with them in your landscaping. Mingle them in with other perennials, or you can even, in an open woodland setting where there is some sun coming through, there are roses that grow in light shade like that. And you can use them as a specimen plant in the center. I have a couple of roses in my yard now that freestanding, no trellis, go up 8, 10, 12, 13 feet.
My gosh, they sound like monsters.
And
beautiful
they
monsters.
Do. And they're really neat. And if you wanted to make a spectacular vision point. It'd be good to plant a couple of those close together and just make a really fountain of interest. Those roses bloom once. They don't bloom repeatedly like the hybrid teas do, but they make a beautiful display when they do bloom. One has quite interesting thorns. They're really prickles, but thorns on it are called Rosa Xanthina Spontanea. And it has the leaflets, instead of being 5 or 7, as you typically think of it, there's probably 11 or 13 little leaflets on the leaf, compound leaf.
And that was
so it has a very ferny feeling to it.
Wow.
But lots of prickles. People who walk by it call it the blood rose, because it usually reaches out and spanks you.
Yeah.
But
Rosa Xanth, what was it?
Rosa Xanthina Spontanea. Xanthina means yellow or sun. And spontanea is how it grows up in a big vase shape.
Great. Well, I can tell that you are just bursting with so much information and knowledge with this topic that I don't want to feel like you're being held back anymore with my questions about, you know, how you got started. So I'd love to hand the reins over to you, Joan, and have you just dig in the areas I know you're eager to share with us.
Okay, but direct me if there's areas I haven't made clear.
I'll do that.
Roses can be really tough. We have some that I always say, almost meaning it, they could grow in concrete. They are persistent. Roses want to grow, and if you choose the right rose for that right place, you're going to be happy with it. But if you plant a rose in the place where it's not getting the qualities of horticulture that it needs, the culture it needs, you're not going to be happy, and you're going to blame the rose, where the blame probably belongs on you planting that rose there. Planted somewhere else might do really fine. Typically, roses do need about 6 hours of sunlight a day. And the thing about living in our high areas here, we get a lot of bounce-back light that sometimes people don't think about. The bounce-back light could be light coming back from a house, side of a house, a street, a fence, something of that type where the light hits and bounces back. So because we have this bounce-back light, we sometimes can grow in a light shade that rose that normally would have to have full sun. So that expands the range of things you can do with your roses. The roses here, all roses want good drainage. And once you can check to see if you do have that, the old way was dig a hole, fill it with water, and see how long it takes to drain. Mm-hmm. Or in a moderately moist soil, you can take the two ends out of a huge can, a coffee can or something, fill that with water, and see how rapidly that water drains. We have water on my hill that would still be there 2 days later.
Mm-hmm. Mine too.
So that meant we had to add soil amendments. And this can be in the form of compost or expanded shale or something that will help pull those particles of clay apart. I think they say clay is 0.002 of an inch across, so you really can't see a particle of clay like you can see a particle of sand. But you can add amendments that pull that apart, give air, and the roses are happy. I think other plants are happy, too, when they get good drainage. In the various subfamilies of roses, I'll give a real little quick 2 minutes of history, if you don't mind, Ava. All roses are native to the northern hemisphere. That means no species roses, or what I call the grandpa roses, were ever found south of the equator. Roses introduced there grow well, because we have great roses in Australia, New Zealand, South America, South Africa, India, but they weren't there originally. And so the roses were crossed from those to come up with all these various subfamilies. You have a whole alphabetic soup of roses, albas, bourbons, China, damask, eglantieria, fetida, you know, on and on and on. which are complicated to comprehend. So I think sometimes it's easier to forget that part, look up some of the names and try from there as to what will grow well in our area. They have had tremendous success in Canada with hybridizing for Canadian conditions, where their roses can be good for zone 3 and 4. And so when you find roses that are called Canadian hardies in one way or another, those roses are ones that would be good to try. And these Canadian hardies may be categorized as hybrid cortezae or hybrid rugosas, but they're, because they've been grown up there, they are called Canadian hardy roses. And some of those are just super great roses. You've got Henry Hudson, which grows a couple of feet high and is a pretty white, just a hint of pink in it at times. And it could make even a nice little hedge. They had a nice hedge of that at Denver Botanic Gardens for a number of years. And it blooms repeatedly. They have old John Davis, which can be grown as a slight climber, even in, you know, mountain areas or high plains areas, because it is so vigorous, beautiful pink. There's Morden's Blush and Morden's Centennial, nice big shrubs that just toss out these double roses like private bouquets. They're beautiful to grow. And a Morden Sunrise, which just is more recent on there, it's a sickle with sort of yellow blushed pink, but blooms well. And one of the ones that I always think could be called grown in concrete is William Baffin. William Baffin, I think, could take a zip code. It's so big.
Did you say William Baffin?
William Baffin, B-A-F-F-I-N.
Okay.
The roses in Canada, they came from a group just above North Dakota and also one on the eastern edge of Canada. And one whole group was called the Explorer Series. So that's where you get all these names, William Baffin from Baffin Bay.
Oh, okay.
And William Baffin has rich pink with little flippets of white going through it in more of a semi-double. And it repeats all summer. And he has glorious fall color in rich shades of yellow, gold, and tan. And it's a lovely three-season type bush. So it's one that, given a good proper hole, foot or 14 inches deep, good 18 inches wide, prepared soil, that rose will just really grow quite well. One other thing I should mention on buying rose plants, they come in two ways, basically. One is a grafted rose, and the other is an own root rose. Just a quick explanation. The grafted rose is, they plant usually Dr. Huey rose, which is an old vigorous climber. Thorny, blooms once, kind of ugly, nothing too great. And everybody will end up with a Dr. Huey if you have grafted roses, because Dr. Huey wants to grow. So if anything happens to the top, Dr. Huey takes over. Or even if it doesn't, they send up something up from the root, from the Dr. Huey root stock, and you need to cut that out where it originates. But Dr. Huey, they plant acres of that, and then when Dr. Huey starts growing, they then graft on another rose, like William Baffin, let's say. And then when William Baffin starts to grow, they cut off Dr. Huey's neck, and then all the strength of that climber, Dr. Huey, goes into producing the William Baffin rose. Or they can grow just stem cuttings from William Baffin, and that's called own root. The own root roses grow very well. They're just a little smaller when you first buy them, or the stems are a little more slender, because when you buy a grafted rose, all the strength of that climber goes into pushing growth onto the rose that was grafted on the top of it. So you get a bigger bush faster with a grafted rose. And the rootstock of Dr. Huey is very tolerant of high pH, low pH, bad soil, good soil, sand, clay, cold weather, hot weather. So that's why they use a graft, so that it can tolerate different soil conditions and still give you a good rose bush. The own rose, same top and same bottom, may or may not like the soil conditions, but if it does, it grows just beautifully well and just takes a year or so to catch up with the size of the other. 2 to 3 years after you planted the rose, you can't tell if it was grafted or if it was own root. A good many of the old garden shrub and species type roses are own root. So they'll be a little smaller when you first get them. Maybe you need babying a touch that first year and a little care over the winter. And after that, stand back. Mm-hmm. They'll take off and make a great bush. There are rose nurseries that specialize in these kinds of roses. You can't always go to your local nursery and find every one of these, but I always say support your local nurseries. If you don't, they don't have nurseries, so exactly. Do check your local nurseries first for buying before other methods are used.
I'm glad you said that, Joan, because I'm a strong proponent of that also. And
you don't have local nurseries, and you've got to support them.
Yes.
They're great businesses. They make our life so much easier by producing all these other plants that we want.
They do, and they tend to be so full of knowledge compared to
some
of the other national chain stores that offer nurseries as well. I find, I find them not to be as well versed in the local area. So,
and some of the big box stores will get plants in that really don't grow in your area, mm-hmm. but that's what came off the truck.
Right.
You know.
And go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it also because I had been wondering about some of the names you were throwing out, if we are likely to be able to find them at our local nurseries or if
you
we may well.
You may find some. Mm-hmm. The Canadian hardies are the ones that I think you'll find the easiest at a local nursery because they just seem to support those. Some of the species roses, you'll find a few. Almost always you'll find one. Well, it's gone through some name changes as frequently as you can imagine. It was called Rosa rubrifolia, red foliage.
Mm-hmm.
Then we tried for 30 years to get the nurseries to call it that, and they kept calling it Rosa glauca. And then they switched it back to Rosa rubrifolia, and now they just call it red leaf rose. That's a species, and that grows very well in light shade, too. It has sort of gray-green foliage, rosa, red foliage rose, or rosa rubrifolia, or rosa glauca, all those names. It grows in light shade, has beautiful hips, and has a gray-green foliage if in light shade. The birds planted one hip from my rose down at the neighbor's in his barberry hedge, and you can hardly tell it from the barberry hedge because in the full sunlight it has more of a red foliage. I mean, red undertone.
Uh-huh. Now, is
and
that
it's
one...
that...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
You probably were just going to mention it. I feel like I might have heard that variety is less favored by the deer.
I think it survives
uh-huh.
that. There is... like in Colorado, there are four roses that are native species roses to Colorado. One is only possibly found down by Alamosa only, close to the New Mexico border.
Mm-hmm.
But the other three are more available. Rosa woodsii is probably one that most people are familiar with, even if they don't know it. When you're driving along the road cuts and see a little rose bush blooming there, sort of red-stemmed, definitely has gorgeous fall color and hips. That's Rosa woodsii. And then Rosa acicularis and also Rosa arkansasii can be found in different parts of the intermountain areas and where it's been introduced because it does tend to want to spread. And it does provide enough hips to be useful for wildlife feeding, too. The Rosa woodsii, again, a species type. They both have very graceful foliage and are a little brambly at times, but can grow up to 5 and 6 feet when given good cultivation. So those are available, I think, taking one off from the woodside, maybe.
What's the roadside, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, if you could find one that's just, you know, might perish if it stays there, or you can take it home and baby it a bit, and I think you'll find that it's a fun rose to grow. There are nurseries that do ship all over. One has just recently moved back to, in fact, it's only about a mile and a half from my house now, High Country Roses. And High Country Roses had been originated in Colorado, went to Utah, and now is back in Arvada now. But that they have a catalog that is just worth acquiring for reading matter. It's beautifully written, has lots of information in it, and many of the old rose catalogs have tremendous pictures and good information. Let's see.
And that was High Country Roses.
High Country Roses.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And would they have that? I think it might have been the first name you threw out to us, Rosa.
Mm-hmm. Rosa Santana. They very possibly does. If not, Matt can come over and take some more cuttings.
Great. Yeah, that sounds like a real special one.
It's one that has. I have my roses kind of growing under healthful neglect.
Mm-hmm.
I do get busy with other things, and sometimes they don't get all the attention they need. And if they can't take my type of cultivation, then it's shovel prune. Out you go, no ceremony, and in comes another one that maybe can do better in that spot, because I can't always give them all the attention I would like to, so they have to learn to kind of survive on their own.
That's how my
and
garden is.
They do. They do, you know. They don't have to have, and I think hybrid teas are an exception. I love hybrid teas. I would not be without them, but they're not my favorite roses. The ones that I think are my favorites are the old garden roses, old garden shrub and species type roses, and I love the miniatures too. People, if they want to just try a few things, you can even pick up one at the local grocery store, miniature rose.
Mm-hmm.
It'll grow outside. And plant it out there and enjoy it. And if it doesn't live till next year, it's probably not been more than $5 or $6 or $7. You haven't lost a lot, and yet you've had fun watching it grow during the summer. That's what they do in Europe. They buy those roses from various places, and when they stop blooming, they don't even keep them.
Hmm.
But we do. We want to save everything we see, I think. But there are rose types that are really good for our area that I find are ones that I don't want to be without. There's some there's one called Dortmund, which is a hybrid courtesy. Hybrid courtesies came from Germany originally. They originated there, and he grew roses. Courtesies is a four-generation nursery there. He grew roses that were like for park conditions, where they got some care but weren't babied. And so those roses have a built-in toughness. Anytime you see a rose that is the class of a hybrid courtesy, more than likely it will survive, because it just has that inherited toughness to it. And many of the Canadian hardies are of that type. There are roses like, I think Golden Wings would survive many places with just a little shelter. Your roses do like to have the 6 hours of sunlight, good drainage. But in addition to that, they want air circulation, but they also don't want to be blown off their rootstock, so to speak. So if you have a hedge that can cut some of the worst wind, that would be beneficial for growing roses. Wyoming, where the wind is so strong, you can, if you have a barrier, either a shrub barrier or a fence, real fence, that you can plant out from, that it kind of breaks that wind, would probably be beneficial in a tenuous situation. This is just something to keep in mind where you think, where am I going to plant the rose? You can use it in your landscaping, however your landscaping fits. And roses do not have to grow in straight beds. Almost nothing in my yard is straight. It's all at an angle or a curve. And so they are very happy where they're planted. They sometimes you think that, oh, roses have a mystique about them. They don't. They're a plant. The roots go down, tops go up, and you water them. And if you can choose the right one for the right location, you will have such joy watching the blooms come. I do suggest that... Go ahead.
I just wanted to interject a quick little story that I think is so funny about the right place for roses and the wrong place for roses. I had a client last year who told me that there was this picker bush right by where she had to park for work every day and wondered if I could...
A sticker bush,
and I wondered if I could take care of it. And I went over and I saw it, and I had to chuckle because it was a very nice rose plant that happened not to be...
Just a sticker bush.
Yeah, it happened not to be pruning or blooming at the time, but it just drove home, two points. One is that beauty truly is in the eye of the beholder, and she had no idea what she was looking at. And two... Location is so important. As you're saying,
yes,
roses can be fit in anywhere in the garden, but perhaps right on a busy pathway might not be the best place.
That's the best place, no.
Or by the door.
Not where you're getting out of the car door and backing into it.
Yeah.
Not a good place for that, or yucca.
Yes, exactly.
But you can find places for roses if you just look. If you have a raised bed, that's even great. That's really great because you have much more control over the soil in a raised bed, and they're easier to see. Since I'm short, I don't care if they don't grow 12 feet tall the way they do in Georgia. I can't enjoy a 12-foot-tall rose bush that is blooming up over my head unless I'm using it as a background type thing. And some of their, you know, they plant hybrid teas that grow that big there when they put them on a different type of rootstock. So I'm very satisfied to keep them in the 3 to 5 foot range. That's a happy size for me. But I do like a few spectacular ones in their place, just to show that they can do that. But if you're growing like miniature roses, which would be a possibility with protection of growing miniature roses in a raised bed, is great, because then you can do the protection that you need. And if you do have a raised bed for roses, that needs to be wide enough. It needs to be at least 3 feet or more wide, 3 to 4 feet, so that the winter doesn't come ruts. So you do have a good space for horticulture. If you have it just a 2 foot wide rose bed, quite often winter conditions can kill what's in there. So that's one thing to keep in mind if you're planning to do some innovative skit staging of your plants in your garden.
Can I ask you a question about that, Joan?
Surely.
I had another client who I was very honored to be requested to take care of her roses because she lives in an old part of town, and these roses were 80 years plus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I really felt like they were my elders, and I wanted to take such good care of them. It was really an honor, as I said. And they were climbers, and she had a whole collection of different roses, different ages, and not those older climbers, but some of the other ones had mounded soil around the base. And I was wondering if that's sort of just something that people used to do that we've realized now doesn't need to be done, or if it's, and she's just still kept doing it because out of habit or something, or if that's for certain varieties or only grafted.
When you plant a grafted rose, that graft, the top of the graft, should be at least 3 to 4 inches below the surface of the soil. And that's because if we get one of those Wampler winders that get 20 degrees and more below zero and everything should happen to die to the ground level, you still have that 3 to 4 inches of that grafted rose that can come back. And so that's why you plant the graft that deep. Even on own roses, I tend to plant those about an inch or so deeper than what they were when I received them. And that's talking about container-grown roses. And when you plant container-grown roses, when I go to the nursery, people really stare at me because I'm butt up, head down. I don't care how many flowers it has on the bush. I'm looking for the skeleton, the structure of that bush. If I'm going to buy it, I want to buy one that's well-rounded, not all off to one side, one that looks like it's a happy, healthy rose bush with some 3 to 4 good canes coming out. Mm-hmm. And then I take it home. When you take home a container rose, they prune them, yes, but they're pruning hundreds when they get their roses in. So when you get this home, you're looking at that rose bush, and you probably will need to do more additional pruning on it before you plant it. And one caution, if you are buying a rose bush in a container from a nursery where it's grown under any type of shelter, a greenhouse or a flat house or something of that, it needs to be hardened off too, just like your pot of petunias needs to be hardened off. Roses have a waxy layer that grows on their top-bottom surface of the rose leaf, and that doesn't develop if it doesn't need to. So if it's grown in a greenhouse, it doesn't have to develop that cutin layer. So when you bring it home, if you wait a week or 10 days in a carport or under a bush or something like that, that lets the rose harden off, get used to the real sun, the real wind, the real change in temperature, and will be happier when you do plant it. When you plant it properly, that 3 inches below the graft or 3 to 4 inches below the ground level for the graft or a little bit deeper for own root, it will do well and not kind of go through a slump. And when you plant your container roses, scribble your fingers around the side of that cupcake of soil so it kind of lets it break a bit to encourage the roots to grow out. And when you do plant it, water it right next to that main soil ball every few days for a week or two, because that's where it's used to getting its water in the nursery. And yes, you want it to grow out, but right now, until it does start growing out into the rest of the rose bed, it needs the water where the roots are. And those kinds of hints will help you overcome the shock of getting it out in the sun and planting it.
Right, so harden it off when you bring it home.
Harden it off. Mm-hmm. And water it close to the main part of it for a couple of weeks, and then it will be better.
The root ball, in other words. Okay, great.
And then the roots will be encouraged to grow out from that.
Am I understanding correctly, Joan, that you're saying if the graft is planted low enough below the surface of the soil by 3 to 4
mm-hmm.
inches, then we don't have to go through what my client has gone through on an annual basis of mounding more soil around the base for the winter and then clearing it away in the spring? Is that unnecessary?
Yes and no.
Planted
yes,
right?
Sorry, yes and no. If it's a tender variety, and the first year probably wouldn't hurt,
okay.
Just to be sure. But that could be soil. It could be evergreen boughs. If you have a Pfizer anywhere, I'm sure it needs pruning. And that type of covering can be done. I don't do any winter protection per se until it gets 22 degrees in my yard, not where they're giving the weather forecast from, but in my yard when it gets 22 degrees in the fall, then for a couple nights. Then we know that even the dumbest rose should figure out it's getting fall and should maybe appreciate a little protection with some evergreen boughs or raked up leaves, something like that. Even soil, if you know how long and how bad your winter will be, they may need more, but probably not. And once they're established, especially the shrub type roses, they don't need that after they're a little more mature. They usually can come through without too much fuss. Don't prune roses back in the fall unless they're so tall they're going to whip in the wind and shake loose. But prune back in the spring, because winter takes care of our pruning here an awful lot.
Mm.
And so in the spring when you do prune, pruning is kind of a two-step process in the spring. You first take out the dead. Some people say, oh, my roses are growing clear to the tip. They may be growing there, but they're not thriving there necessarily, except for certain shrub roses. When you cut the stem, what's important is not that the rose is growing clear to the tip, but when you make a cut on the stem and look at that cross cut, you want that cross cut to be clear, like fresh wood, clear, creamy, no brown. Then you know that that stem will produce living material. If you first make a cut on your stem and it's brown, you go down lower. And then if you see it has a donut, it's brown in the middle and greenish or clear on the outside, go down lower. I'm a hard pruner. I want to know when I get through pruning that what I've got left is going to produce healthy stems. Mm-hmm. And if you have just the least little bit of brown in the center and most of that area proportion-wise is creamy, that's okay. But cut about 3/8 to a quarter inch, somewhere in that area, above a preferably outward-facing bud eye, a little bit on a slant, 45-degree angle, and cover that cut with Elmer's glue or colored fingernail polish.
Really?
Not just because I said to do that, but there's a reason. Cover every cut with Elmer's glue or colored fingernail polish, not clear. Clear fingernail polish forms like a lens and burns down the tip when the sun gets to it. So you don't have to match the color to the rose color. But colored fingernail polish or Elmer's glue, and that prevents a little wasp who comes by. She sees this nice fresh cut stem, bores a hole, lays an egg, stuffs in a leaf, lays an egg, stuffs in a leaf. And when the larvae hatch, they keep going on down, and you end up with a cane with a hole in it. So if you cover it with the Elmer's glue, just the normal Elmer's glue, that may discourage her to go maybe to the neighbors and make a home over there instead of in your rose bed.
Wow, I've never heard that before, Joan. Is that with all types of roses?
Uh-huh. Anytime you make a pruning cut on a rose bush, not a tree, trees heal on their own, but on a rose bush, if you cover that cut, if it's a quarter inch stem or so, you know, you're the little tiny baby stems, maybe not, but when it's a nice size stem, cut that rose, and that's in the summer when you're cutting off a bloom to bring in the house or because it's faded. Go down far enough on the stem. On repeat flowering rose bushes, you think, well, I don't want to hurt the bush, so I'll cut right under the flower. No, because that just gives you a little bitty growth, bigger growth, finally a rose growth that brings you a bloom. So cut down to where it's going to do that to begin with, and you increase the number of times the rose will repeat bloom faster. So, you know, close to pencil thick or so. But cut down far enough when you take that faded bloom off that it will produce, if it's a repeat blooming, will produce you a new flower. Quarter inch, 3/8 of an inch above the bud eye, preferably on an outward facing bud eye so that you grow your bush more open and not inward so that it has lack of air circulation. And those things help prevent diseases and you know, that kind of situation developing when it gets that good air circulation. Mm-hmm. So in the spring when you prune, first you take out the dead. Even if you get nervous and there's only 2 inches of stem left, I take out the dead. Then second, I look at what's left, and then I prune for shape. So it's kind of a two-part operation, and then I put the Elmer's glue on in the spring.
And I've found, Joan, from reading and experience, that the time to grow or to prune your roses is when they have formed a bud but haven't broken bud yet. Is that correct?
In the spring, you mean?
In the spring. And usually I believe it's, I want to say late March here in my area, 6,800.
Oh, when you do the pruning?
Yeah.
I do the pruning. Well, you can do it two ways. You can prune really early, like February, March, April, 1st of April, and then cover the bush if it's going to freeze. Or you can wait until the last freeze has come. If we only knew when the last freeze was, would life be easier?
Even if,
but
it's,
if you wait till
leafed
the,
out, you can prune.
And after you've leafed it out, you think, I'm cutting away all this foliage. Well, you're pruning out that which is not going to support life in August. Because if you prune and it has a lot of dead wood, brown in the middle of that cut, roses store their energy right under the skin of the stem. And so if you have a very thin stem, you have a thin amount of energy. And if you cut down to where it's closer to pencil thick, you have a lot more energy for that rose stem to give to the new bud coming out. So even though you've got 6-8 inches, a foot, whatever, that you're cutting off to where you know that the growth that comes after your pruning is going to be growing on healthy wood and not just a little bit of stored energy before it hits that dead spot and calls for more water coming up from the roots, and it can't do it because it's dead. Mm-hmm. And then the growth slumps, and you think, oh, I need to spray it, or what has come? Mm-hmm. And it's because you didn't prune properly.
A friend who taught me to prune roses told me something that made so much sense also, which is sometimes you have that little, that real spindly growth, and maybe it's
yes.
plenty healthy, and so I think a lot of people feel bad cutting that, but the way she put it to me made so much sense. She kind of put her finger on it to make it kind of bounce, you know, and said, do you uh-huh. think that this little spindly thing can support a nice, big, healthy bloom? And
right.
the answer is obvious. No, it can't. So mm-hmm. you just remove mm-hmm. those.
Yeah, you get away the fritter-fratter, get closer back to the skeleton structure
uh-huh.
on most roses. Now, with hybrid tea, I mean, with hybrid teas primarily, too, but with your old garden shrub and species roses, sometimes almost all the stems look like they're good and living, and yet you feel it's kind of cluttered.
Mm-hmm.
So you can prune back some of the stems about a third 1 year, and then prune back some other stems back about a third the next year on those that do tend to live almost to the tip. That's another way to approach pruning in the spring, to kind of just give it portions of it a good haircut, or even take some stems down to the very bottom. When a stem does die, you must take it off at the very bottom, especially on a grafted rose. If you take it off where it's easy, that it has that stub coming out of the graft, well, where it's dead, it can't be living. So if you cut that stub clear down to where you reach the clear budwood looking like new lumber, then it could sprout another bud eye and come up and give you a new stem. But if that dead stub is staying there, you can't get any new growth coming from it.
And that's
One other thing before I lose my train of thought, water. Water, water, water. Water is most important. You want to see that the roses could get an inch of water a week if you can. If they get more, they'll be a little happier, but they'll survive on an inch of water a week. Probably best if you get into the 90 degree days. A couple of extra batches of water would be helpful. But water is terribly important in the wintertime, and water in the wintertime is probably one of the reasons why roses die, or lack of water in the wintertime. When we get those fun days where it's just beautiful and gets to 45 degrees or above, in the middle of December or January or whenever, go check your ground. That is, assuming it's not snow-covered. Check your ground. Dig down 3 or 4 inches and feel. If that soil is moist, great. If that soil is not moist, then when it's going to be above 45 degrees in the winter, water and let that soak through. And that will help your rose make it through the winter. More roses die from lack of watering in the winter, I think, than other reasons. The reason why you're so conscious of water is that roots in dry soil have much more winter injury than roots in moist soil. Having that water in the soil over the winter helps moderate the plunges, severe plunges up and down of the temperature, and that helps bring your roses through in the wintertime. And, again, pay attention to what it's doing in your yard and not necessarily where the weather forecast is coming from or how much rain they say it got at the airport. It's how much rain did you get in your yard.
Right. Very good advice. Makes a lot of sense. Look at our own situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, Joan, I do want to get wrapping up our talk here. There are a couple last things that I'd really love to have you address in just a couple minutes, if you're open to that. So one thing that I see a lot of people wondering about is rose suckers. And what I've been taught is that rose suckers will either not produce any flowers or else subpar flowers, and that they take the energy from the mother plant, and you should never let suckers grow. So if you could talk about whether those things are true or not, and if there are any varieties you might want to let sucker, that would be great.
If you have own root roses, anything that suckers from an own root rose is that rose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have one rose I love dearly Desiree Parmentier, which is the most bodacious flaunting gotta come see me, smell me rose that ever did exist. It has hundreds of petals in deep, rich pink, and it's just you smell it when you come up to the bush. When the petals fall off, it looks like pink ink all over the grass. But it behaved really well for 15 years, and then it said, okay, here I go. And I suddenly had 30 feet of rose bush.
Wow.
Because it sucker, 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 sucker. So in that case, it was all the same rose, but I had just a bit too much of that rose.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been digging it out quite a bit since then, but it could be grown where the roots were more constrained. It might not give that problem. But when you have suckers that come up, it's usually will be on a grafted rose, and that sucker that comes up probably is Dr. Huey, as I said, because it's such a tough old rose. That foliage will look different from the foliage on your bush that you paid the money for. Say Peace Rose Bush. Everyone knows Peace. So if Peace was a grafted rose, and suddenly you have these great big tall shoots coming up, and you think, wow, look at it very carefully and learn to see what you're looking at to identify, is this a vigorous shoot of Peace, or is this a vigorous shoot of Dr. Huey? Compare the leaflets side by side. Are the leaflets shaped? One might be larger than the other. Are they shaped the same way? Are the serrations along the edges the same to identify, yes, this is the same rose? At the very base of every leaf on every rose is a little bract called stipule. And this is a little leaf-like appendage that is attached to the base of every leaflet. Those stipules help you in identifying the rose. Some are skinny, some are pointed, some are fringed, some are wide, some are narrow. So pull off a leaflet from this vigorous shoot and pull off a leaflet from your other rose bush and compare the stipules. Run your finger down the back of the main stem, the petiole, of your rose leaf. Some of those have prickles on the back of the main stem, the little main stem on the leaflet. Some don't. Compare, do they both have prickles? Does one have it and one doesn't? So these are ways to identify this strange shoot that came up. Is this a stranger or is this the same root, same rose I purchased, and it's just got an extra vigorous stem coming?
Mm-hmm.
And if that is the rootstock, you can't really cheat by cutting it off at ground level. Pruning is a stimulus to growth, so now he'll send up two stems. So dig down a hole, down, follow that leaflet, that vigorous shoot down to where it originated under the ground, and cut it off at that point, and then fill back the soil. Does that give you an idea?
Yeah, that's very helpful. It's a much more thorough understanding than I had before, and I hope everyone else listening can say the same. So thank you for clarifying that. And then the one last thing, well, I wanted to just mention, when you were talking about pruning out the dead and how important that is, just for our listeners, I just want to make sure they know that that's any time of the year, right? That's not just...
Any time you see dead, you can prune it out. Like on climbers in the spring, mm-hmm. I only want to prune out the dead, period. Let them do their bloom, mm-hmm. no matter how bad it may look. And then after they bloom in the spring on climbers, I may go in and do the other pruning to shape.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's dead, dead can be taken out at any time. In the spring, you're dying to get out there and do, because you've had two beautiful days in a row and yet you know it's going to freeze. Constrain yourself to taking out only that which is obviously dead and leave a two-inch piece on that bush that is still dead, but that you get everything above that. We have green coming up and then it turns to brown. Cut above that green 2 or 3 inches and get rid of those dead stems from the top and dispose of those. That'll keep you busy and not hurt anything, because pruning is a stimulus to growth, so you prune it down into the green and then it stimulates growth and then you get a freeze and all that succulent tissue dies. So in the spring when you can't stop it, just go out and prune the dead out, that leave that gap of dead above the green.
Great. And then I know you have some resources you want to share, but one last question I want to ask you first is about, well, we kind of talked about how to mitigate clay soils And I know mm-hmm. a lot of our listeners have very sandy soils, which obviously have great drainage, but how mm-hmm. do we keep the roses happy with that? Is it just a simple matter of adding organic matter?
Mm-hmm. The nice thing is both work for closed soils that are too tight, soils that are too loose for drainage, add organic material. There is one caution I do want to mention, Ava, on this that has only come out recently in the last couple of years. See if you can get some of the pH tester strips or some way to test pH. And the whole nursery in industry is finding that, amazingly enough, two bags side by side in the nursery or the same nursery offering the same soil mix that they offer year after year can vary extremely on the pH. So that you really need to check the pH before adding organic so that you aren't adding something that's too acid.
Sure, right. And we aren't going to go into this now, but you mentioned earlier in the talk maybe, you definitely did, that adding expanded shale uh-huh. is a good idea. And I just want to kind of put that hook out for our listeners because you and I, Joan, discussed that you would like to have a whole program on the wonders of expanded shale and that it's a product most people haven't heard of yet, at least in my experience here. And
right.
it can be such a huge help. So I'm glad that
you'll... Especially in clay soils. But yeah. just remember, on clay soils and sandy soils, the amendment to this, for soils is the same, adding organic material, since we'll talk about expanded shale another time, yeah. adding organic material. In clay, it spreads the particles apart. In sand, it helps stuff up the air spaces.
Great.
Is the way I use as an explanation as to why you add organic.
Yeah, that helps. It really makes it very clear on both levels what it's doing there. So thank you. And there's a resource that you told me about called Growing Roses in Colorado. Can you just
yes.
speak to what that is and how it might help people and where they can find it real quick?
Yes. This is a booklet put out by Denver Rose Society. It's got to be good. I wrote a good deal of it, right?
Excellent.
But it's 52 pages about long, and it has a list of resources in there of our consulting rosarians so that you can, these are people who will be glad to answer your questions, and we have them in Colorado, Idaho, and Utah that can answer your questions on roses. It tells you how to buy, what to look for, how to plant, how to water, how to mulch, how to fertilize, recommended varieties, and recommended varieties by type. So if you go to the nursery and want to buy, and the rose is listed in our book, and there's two red roses, which should you buy? If you want to be safest, buy the one that's recommended in our booklet. They're not the first easiest roses. I mean, they're not the newest roses out, but they're roses that have proven their worth. The book called Growing Roses in Colorado. I think you can find all the information you need about it by checking our website, or they can certainly email me, too. The website is denverrosesociety.org. So it's DenverRose, the double R in there, denverrosesociety.org. And that will bring you to our website. The membership and the booklet are $15. If you do buy the booklet, and if you want the membership, you also get our newsletter, which is full of good information, and it keeps you aware of what activities are going on in this area if you're close enough to come, such as the first Sunday in June this year at Denver Botanic Gardens. We will be having our old rose display. This is just a display. It's not a judged show, and we encourage anyone who can to bring in whatever's growing in roses in their yard so everyone can see it. It smells so good when you walk in the room. But it's not a judged show, and it's just to show you what could be blooming at this time in your yard in roses. But the Growing Roses in Colorado booklet comes with the membership or can be purchased independently, and it is filled with good information. It's written at a nice level. Not too scientific. It's not baby talk. It's just like we're sitting down and talking with you.
It sounds so helpful, and so does the show. It sounds wonderful. Are there rose societies, Joan, in most states and most metropolitan areas that folks listening from Utah, Idaho, Montana could find locally?
There are a couple in Idaho, and there isn't one in Wyoming at this time. We have in Denver, we have one in Loveland, in Longmont, Boulder, Denver, and also in the Four Corners area. And so there are scattered out through that way. Utah has a Rose Society, Utah Rose Society, and it meets generally in Salt Lake City. So there are some around. I'm not quite as sure in Montana. Parts of Montana belong to our area, and parts of Montana belong to Pacific Northwest. If they want that information positively, you can contact American Rose Society, ars.org, or AmericanRoseSociety.org, and they can get that information out to you as to where your contacts would be for reaching a local rose society. And it's just people who love to talk about roses. So if you like roses, rose societies are a good place to be.
Great. Well, Joan, thank you so, so much for all of the excellent, high-quality information. I think that this will be a tremendous start to get lots of people enthused about growing roses and a bunch of know-how to dig in and add that touch of classic beauty to their gardens. So,
they're fascinating.
Thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ava.
Yeah, we'll talk to you later, Joan.